I'm going to follow on from Susie and also talk about climate breakdown and the Dharma from some slightly different angles. And I'm talking about it in large part because I think climate breakdown is a huge ethical moral issue, been called the biggest moral issue of our time. I would go along with that. And to my mind, the Dharma, a central part of the Dharma, has to do with ethics and values. And I think the Dharma is actually, or can be, very good at investigating, looking at what's behind unhelpful patterns, unhelpful behaviour. At times, in cultures gone by, there were sacrifices to appease gods. Animal sacrifices, occasionally human sacrifices. And we might look back at that and think, God, you know, what were they thinking? But I think it's fair enough to say that we are sacrificing a stable climate and the well-being of people in the future for short-term gain, short-term convenience, pleasures. And, you know, you could even see it that we are actually witnessing that sacrifice. We're in the midst. We don't see all the consequences. I've been giving talks on climate and Dharma for 10 years now. And in the early talks, and I've still got them, I talked about how this is going to be a problem. That wasn't that long ago. I don't need now to say this is going to be a problem. When I started giving the talks, carbon dioxide was about 395 parts per million. And you might remember it was a big deal when it hit 400. We've sort of forgotten that now. And now it's around 417. So that's about a 5% rise, but there's been way more than a 5% rise in extreme weather. And this highlights the point, really, that, you know, it's fairly accepted now that it's non-linear. Carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere go like that, but the effects go much quicker, you know, not the same gradient. And you probably know, some people say, oh, well, we have to get used to this extreme weather. Well, it's actually not having to get used to the extreme weather. It's having to get used to things getting worse and worse. That's different. Now, it's not as if there are not people, and I know a number of us here are activists, who are doing enormous amount to try and change things around. A huge amount. Not only individuals, but some government efforts, corporate efforts, some very dedicated people. And yet this happens in a context where fossil fuel companies have phenomenal power. Phenomenal power. The estimate of fossil fuel industry profits is, in Australian dollars, about, this is not just one company, this is broadly, about $4.4 billion per day for every day of the last 30 years. And that's enough to shift the views of politicians, to shift how climate is presented in the media, and support denial, doubt and delay. It's enough to develop greenwashing campaigns, enough to colour the situation with a sense of normality. And it's not just the fossil fuel industry. I'm sure some of you know George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist. Yes, a few nods. Yep. I thought this was well written. And, you know, he's talking about the context. That how do we account for the fact that almost everyone in public life subscribes to the same set of preposterous beliefs? Nearly everyone who appears in the media seems to accept that economic growth can and should continue indefinitely on a finite planet. Almost all believe that the unhindered acquisition of enormous wealth by a few people is somehow acceptable. They believe the taxes sufficient to break the cycle of accumulation and redistribute extreme wealth are unthinkable. They believe permitting a handful of billionaires to own the media, set the political agenda, and tell us where our best interests lie is fine. No terror or torture is required to persuade people to fall into line with these crazy beliefs. So that's the context we're in. That's the context. And it's not just climate. Look, I'm speaking to the converted, I know, but, you know, insects, wildlife, increasingly polarized politics. And in that context, there's people that are doing extremely good work and developing technologies, sciences with international cooperation. You might have seen a chart like this. This goes from, and I've actually got copies over there on that table, just to look at afterwards. So this is from 1960 to 2020. This is parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere going up. And these are the World Meteorological Conference on Climate, Scientists Warning, Kyoto Protocol, UN Framework from Climate Change, Copenhagen Agreement, Paris Agreement, Second World Scientists Warning to Humanity. So all these things, and the chart keeps going up. Now, that's not to say that all those things haven't been immensely helpful. You know, I think it came out really well yesterday that even though there may not be observable huge changes, things people do stop things getting worse. So, you could say we're at the beginning of runaway climate change. That's a fair comment. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, said last year, we're seemingly light years away from reaching our climate action targets. And then this year, not so long ago, he said, we're on a highway to climate hell and our foot is on the accelerator. He's not a radical activist.
It's terrible.
Yeah. So, to my mind, one of the things practice can be good at is really looking at what goes on for us. And that includes what goes on for us on an emotional level. And so all sorts of things happen to people. I include myself very much so in relation to climate. So I'll run through these things, just see if you can relate to each of them. So one of them is, well, it could come under the general heading of confusion. You hear something that's terrible and then there's about what's happening and then somehow the way things get presented, there's a sense of normality and there's the World Cup scores or the soccer and people think, oh, well, you know, it's like life goes on. So there can be a wavering, basically, in terms of one's attitude towards how one should respond, sometimes called confusion. Could be a bleakness of attitude. Bleakness could go to a bit more depressive, could be grief at what's already lost. I was reading about Lisa Van Susteren, the American psychiatrist, member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She says, for people who involve themselves in climate science and the response, to not be feeling the symptoms of grief would be odd. Could be anger. Maybe anger at what some corporations are doing. You might have noticed In the news just a few weeks ago here in Australia, the fossil fuel lobby threatened a $20 million advertising campaign if Labor does not rule out a windfall profits on mining, profits tax on mining. Okay. I got angry about that one after reading it. And then apprehension, or which might come with some level of stress. Next, further up the scale on apprehension goes to anxiety or maybe fear. Curiously, George Monbiot has said, we're not nearly scared enough, and that's why we're not acting. Now, that's not us individually, that's, I think, collectively. That's, to me, that's an interesting point in a Dharma community where often there's a focus on equanimity and calmness and, yeah, anyway. Could be a numbness. You hear about so many things, so many effects. In the end, it's like, will you just tune out a bit? Could be a sense of powerlessness. Susie talked about hope. I was involved in some of the Extinction Rebellion actions, and a lot of people there had the view that ordinary channels weren't working, and so that's why we had to do these extreme things. And so now they've been at least curtailed because of the new laws. Up to 2 years in prison for being on one of 700 streets in Sydney, I think. So, you know, I can imagine hopelessness would be felt by some people. I mean, one of the interesting things for me was that some climate scientists have been reluctant to say how bad it is because they're worried that people will go to a space of despair. So they've been, not all, but some climate scientists. So they've been putting a hopeful or a positive spin on what's possible. And personally, I'm not sure that explaining how bleak it looks necessarily leads to despair. That's one possibility. But, you know, or let's say saying there's going to be a catastrophe, that doesn't necessarily lead to despair. I've been struck by the spirit of so many, I don't know them personally, people in Ukraine. Yeah, look at what they've done.
Picked up during the fires.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So incredibly awful.
Yeah.
But it kind of like, we've got to do something.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yep. Some of you would know of Jim Bendel. Yes, he's a professor of sustainability, widely respected. He talks about inevitable near-term societal collapse. Now, he doesn't say what near-term is, 10 years, 20 years, more. And when he talks about societal collapse, he leaves it open in terms of what that means. Does that mean law and order goes or not? But that sense of possible societal collapse doesn't really get much attention. We often take out insurance policies for things we don't think is going to happen. But now, I don't often quote our late Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, in Dharma talks. But this is an exception. Years ago, in 2008, at the London School of Economics, Queen Elizabeth II asked a question about something that was pretty small compared to climate breakdown. She asked about the global financial crisis, and she asked, why did nobody see it coming? Now, there was a longer response from the British Academy a year later. And it's a response of quite a few pages, but in the end, it says, So in summary, Your Majesty, the failure to foresee the timing, extent and the severity of the crisis and to head it off, while it had many causes, was principally a failure of the collective imagination of many bright people, both in this country and internationally, to understand the risks to the system as a whole. So, a failure of the collective imagination. So, how easy would it be for us to imagine some form of societal collapse in Australia? You might be able to imagine a starting point, like a system that simply isn't able to cope with the damage from frequent extreme weather events, a system that has regular crop failures, and then that puts prices up a lot, and then sometimes it's called the precariat class, people who are in a precarious situation, they're the ones that sort of fall through the cracks. I mean, that could be a sort of beginning. Yeah. Dharma perspectives. I think a lot of our responses come from grief or anger or whatever it is, come from a sense of a relationship to the planet, the land, to other creatures, and like any other relationships, when something is hurt, we have something that we're in, someone, let's say, we're in relationship is hurt, we can have quite a strong response. But it could be that it's more than just a relationship. It could be that even though we may not use the word, we have some sense of sacredness when we think of places or a stable climate. Sacredness is more than just appreciating a beautiful place. It's one thing to say, oh yeah, it's a beautiful place, yeah, it'd be nice to protect it. Or, yeah, it's a good climate, yeah, it'd be nice to keep this one. It's different. It's more. And, you know, when I say sacredness, I mean subjectively sacred. But it doesn't have to be subjectively sacred just for me or you. It could be subjectively sacred for many, many, many people. It would be great if that sense of sacredness could be spread. But that's no easy task. That's no easy task. But to my mind, that could be part of the response, part of the picture. You know, as you'd know, a big part of Dharma practice is non-harm or minimizing harm. And you know, that includes what we can do to minimize harm that others are doing. That includes political engagement, minimizing what corporations, governments do. And it includes what we do, how we live. There was one Buddhist-based practice that I did years ago, maybe 2005, 2006, called Nikan practice. Anybody heard of that? Nikan. N-A-I-K-A-N. It's Japanese, Buddhist-based. It's not straight Buddhist practice, but it's based on reflecting on three questions. There are three questions which can have slightly different objects, but they're the same general gist. So it's three questions are, what did I receive from the world, let's say, today? I mean, you could even do it with a partner. What did I receive from a partner? What did I give to the world? What did I contribute today? And the third one, what problems or difficulties do I think I've caused today? And there's a question that's not asked, a silent question, which is, what problems or difficulties did other people create for me? That one's not asked. It's just these three. So I did that practice for quite a while, and it got me to really look at, okay, what's my impact in the world? And, you know, not just think about it occasionally, but this is a practice. Practice every day. Okay, last 24 hours, what did I do? What did I do? And I really started to look at my carbon footprint. And that was about 15, 16 years ago. And maybe for the first 5 years or so, I used the then carbon calculators or tables and figured out what parts of my life were contributing this way or that way, and I added up all my carbon for the year, and I sort of looked at all the different offset schemes, and you know, some were seemed pretty credible, some like the airline offsets are sort of like pretty greenwashy really. And so I, you know, in a way, I did that religiously for about 5 years. Every year, looked through which offset scheme seemed best. But then, in about 2011, 2012, I started to look a lot more closely at offsets and take into account the urgency of action, which to me became apparent back then. Some offset schemes, it's like, oh, yeah, look, in 20 years, you know, we will have captured your carbon. It's like, yeah, okay, well, it's a bit late. and it's ongoing. I came to the conclusion that, at least for me, carbon offsets were no solution. That doesn't mean that they can't be helpful. It doesn't mean they can't be helpful. Look, metaphors have their limits, but the metaphor that I quite liked is that carbon offsets are like kicking your dog and then giving 50 cents to the RSPCA. You know, it's like, well, you're doing harm and you're doing good, and so it cancels it all out. Well, I mean, look, it's not quite like that, but when I looked at what I could do to minimise my footprint, I could see the biggest thing that I could easily change was flying. And, you know, I lived some of the time in Brisbane, some of the time in Sydney. And so I stopped flying, unless I really, really needed to. So haven't flown in Australia for a decade. One time I had a really sore back. I couldn't sit in a train for hours and hours. So I flew. So I flew that time. And I had the time to do that. Not everybody has the time to do that. I wanted to see my teacher, my Dharma teacher, wonderful, wonderful teacher in England. And so I went from Sydney to London mainly by overland. And that's, you know, that was a long trip. And then a few years later he was dying and I wanted to see him again. So I went mainly overland again, most of the way overland again. But there again, that's more expensive than flying. You need some weeks. But for me, it relates to what I was saying the other night about conscience. It's me wanting to do the right thing. It fits better with my conscience doing that way. I sort of align myself with particular values. And look, people's situation are really different. I can see not everyone's is able to do what I do. What struck me though is that in our culture, there's a sense of entitlement about relatively high emissions activities. Other people do it. If other people are going on regular overseas holidays, well, why not me? We take our cue from what other people do. You know, we go often by societal norms. Having said that, often societal norms change by some people, sometimes just a few people, and then more people changing those norms. Another factor, I think, is that there is a real sense of lack in our culture. That's one translation of dukkha. Some people just love travelling and they find it nourishes them in some way, and that's so, okay, that's what happens. Yes, there's other ways to address a sense of lack, but maybe they're not always so accessible. The other aspect of this is that stands out is that there's a sense that the physical world is, in a way, the only real world. Now, that might sound strange, but I will talk more about that in the next talk. And so, because the physical world is seen as the only real world, people want to go to more and more places or have more things or have more culinary experiences or go to new cultures, whatever. So, I mean, to my mind, that is part of the problem. Also, despite Dharma having such a clear focus on non-harm, it's striking to me that dedicated practitioners sometimes do, teachers, including teachers, do multiple trips overseas, holiday trips sometimes in a year. One teacher's, inside teachers, taking a whole group to Bali, everyone's flying to Bali, doing a retreat and flying back. I won't say any names. But it gets to the point where there's an expression called behavioural denial. People accept that, yeah, climate change is a problem, but they're behaving as if it's not. Now, for anyone interested, on that table over there, afterwards, I've left an updated table of the carbon footprint calculator, so you can just get a bit of an idea if you're interested, or maybe you just don't want to know. Now, for me, cutting back on flying, I'm happy to do it, but it has been a bit of a sacrifice in a way. It means I don't go to things. Years ago, I would have flown up for something, or I would have done more things with my teacher in England, when he was doing shorter retreats, and I just thought, no, it's, the cost in terms of the planet is too much. He recorded all his talks. I listened to his talks. I used to have phone interviews with him too, so way better. So, yes, it's sacrifices, but it feels like I'm aligned with something that I value, and so, in a way, compensates. You might have heard of the term ecological debt. Anybody heard of that term? Yep. Ecological debt. It's another way of looking at this. It's been described in these terms. If you take more than your fair share of a finite natural resource, you run up an ecological debt. If you have a lifestyle that pushes the ecosystem beyond its ability to renew itself, you run up an ecological debt. Ecological debt can be owed to other people, individuals, other species, species as a whole, future people, or generations. No one is going to come knocking on your door asking for a debt repayment. It's a question of your willingness to look at it or not. Now, there was a study on, called The Psychodynamics of Ecological Debt by Rosemary Randall, I think, very good writer on psychology and climate, and she outlines what can happen when people come to terms with this sort of debt, come to really connect their behaviour with the impact in the wider world.
Rosemary
Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. It's part of a book. You can look her up. She's got some talks, but the article itself is really good. It's part of a longer book, I think, called Engaging with Climate Change. To me, it's by far the best article in the whole book. I've photocopied it. If anybody's interested, I'm happy to email it to you. Just give me an email. She wrote, "It can be a slow dawning process or journey that some of us take or are taking. It hinges on our relationship to others and to the natural world, and the journey moves away from a sense of disregard and unexamined entitlement. The journey involves making changes in how we live. There's often a sense of loss, and it's not uncommon to have conflicts with old friends centred around ecological debt." I can attest to that one. Once the connection between our lifestyle and ecological debt is made, the knowledge can't be brushed away. And She describes it as a type of awakening. Kind of interesting. Now, to my mind, one person's action does change things tiny, tiny bit, but that person also can influence others. And, you know, the Buddha did talk about the importance of influence. So there's one place in the Pali Canon where the Buddha talks about five prerequisites of developing the wings of awakening. First one, having admirable people as friends, companions and colleagues. So basically saying, acknowledging that we get influenced. We get influenced. So, I mean, to me, influence actually has a bigger impact than one's personal lower emissions. So looking at this stuff, there's often a clash of values, and which is sometimes called an antinomy. Antinomy, not antimony. Antimony is the element in the periodic table. And antinomy is the clash of values. Anyway, so, for instance, we might value doing the right thing. We value the convenience of flying or going to other places. We value a wide, varied diet with imported foods. We value doing the right thing by eating local food or by not eating meat or by possibly not eating dairy products. We value having a low impact if we drive, and we value, and we know an electric car would probably be good, and we value having enough money in the bank. To my mind, these sort of clashes are a part of practice. You know, it's not as if things are just straightforward. We work through these things. It can be an ongoing challenge, and what we value might shift over time. And I'm not at all saying here that one's personal lifestyle is more important than political action. I think they're both important. And sometimes with personal action, you know, we get the sense, well, God, it's just me, you know, what can I do? Some of you know of the Theravada teacher, Bhikkhu Anilaya. Yes, some nods, yeah. He said, it's not a matter of asking what I can do. It's a matter of saying, what can we do? It's not a matter of just framing it as you on your own. It's being part of a community who is doing what they can. So, finishing up, talked about variety of feelings that we might have that maybe are not even that much talked about at times, just come and go, feelings of bleakness or grief. Maybe there's point in acknowledging them a bit more. Talked about possible failure of the collective imagination in terms of how things could pan out. Talked about the good work, the good dedicated work that many people are doing. The Buddha talked about two middle ways, and one of those is the middle way between indulgence and being hard on yourself, to put it very, probably too briefly. And I think it's fair to say we live in a pretty indulgent culture. And so for us to take the middle way between what we might see as a middle way between being indulgent and being hard on ourselves might be pretty different from the cultural norm. And so that maybe then can be a challenge for us. Now you could ask the question, you could say, well, what might the world ask of us, of each of us? Each of us has got different skills, limitations, abilities, and there could be so many answers to that question. Or you could imagine, let's say, you're having a conversation with someone from the future, someone who's maybe in 30 years' time or 2050, maybe a bit later. Maybe, let's just imagine it. It's a young woman in her 20s And she lives in what Antonio Guterres calls a climate hell. And she's talking to you, and she's wanting to understand what happened in our time. And she's asking, well, so what did you do? So let's have a minute silence and can think about that. And I'm not asking for an answer to that question. I'm just saying it's a question to hold.